So tonight, we are on our 10th week.
Again.
And I'd like to introduce David.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody. My name is Dave. I'm an alcoholic, and it's a privilege to do this and be here with you guys, and you know why. So this weekend, I did something I've never done before. My wife and I went up to the Bill Wilson House in Vermont for the 30th anniversary of the Wilson House, and it was you know, like everything. We kind of, like, I thought it'd be fun, you know. Like, she made me go to Europe one time, and I was like, all right, we'll go to Europe, and it was awesome, you know. We resist everything, and then we realize what we've been missing. You know, we got up there, and we got a tour from an old-timer who really kind of knew the history, and you know how much I enjoy the history, so it was awesome. And then there was a 2 o'clock meeting in the Wilson House. For those, I don't know how many people have been there, but it's a big room in the back, and, you know, it's a great place for an AA meeting, of course, and you can feel it, and you do get some excitable people there, I got to say that. And everyone's out doing the other one. But and then that we saw a viewing of the new Bill W. Documentary. If you've seen that, it's a new release of it with about 15 more minutes, and with the director and producer of it. I think his name was Kevin. I had dinner with him. I hope I wasn't calling him the wrong name. It was great because this guy, you know, he did the movie, he did the film, he took questions and answers afterwards, and, you know, just renewed, you know. I started this thing off by trying to push you guys into reading, you know, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers and Alcoholics Anonymous Comes of Age, you know, because when you read that, you know, it's funny, the movie starts out by somebody saying Bill Wilson had 30,000 reasons to give up, and he didn't, you know. And I was hoping he would expand on that, because there's one book, I'm not sure which book it is, but you're reading about the writing of the big book. And you can read that with the big book in your hand. And you're reading that and you're saying, there's no fucking way they get this accomplished. You know, there's no way. The big book does not get written, you know. They had so many obstacles. And so when I read those things, it gave me such a new gratitude of how lucky we are to have Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And when you, especially that documentary, I mean, you know, I don't know if AA, I mean, obviously it helps us more than hurts us, but it hurt me for a long time because it kept slowing me down from, really, probably from death, you know. But you know, when you hear the documentary and see Bill and see, you know, God bless Lois, you know. One thing was they couldn't have children. I mean, there's a million reasons that Bill, had this happened, we wouldn't have AA. Had Bill made money in the stock deal and made $1 million, he would have abandoned AA. And there's tons of examples. One I learned was they wanted to adopt a child, and they thought they were getting the child, and then they never heard, you know. And they found out years and years later that a friend who was to give a reference gave a bad reference because of Bill's drinking. They never admitted that. But again, if they had gotten this child, would they have abandoned AA, you know? So maybe it's just me. I see God in all of this, you know. I see these things and just see how lucky we are that everything went the way it did. We were talking about faith and faith before the meeting. And I see it in that. They talked about Bill's depression, you know. And they talk, you know, you hear things about Bill's experimentation with LSD, and it wasn't, Bill was upset, as I think a lot of us get upset, devastatingly upset, when people don't get this, you know. When people don't get it, you're just so damn frustrating, you know. And you wish you had the magic phrase or whatever. But Bill's, between his depression and everyone not getting the spiritual awakening that he was hoping they would get, his experiences with LSD were all under a doctor's care, all lying on a couch or a bed, you know. As they say in the movie, wasn't it Haight-Ashbury, you know, listening to the Grateful Dead, you know. But that's what you hear people say, oh, that Bill Wilson, he used LSD in the end. He wasn't really sober, you know. But they really clarify that and why he did it, and I really found that interesting. And it's funny, when my son was little, we always go to the Wildwood Boardwalk, you know, and my son would always wear his wristband for the next week, you know, and I'd be like, you're an idiot, you know. But I don't want to take my wristband off, you know, now I'm like him, you know. But it was really, and then to finish it off, so this morning our plan was to go to the 8 o'clock morning meeting. We heard that was, but we'd been to two meetings, and like I said, they were a little excitable. So we were kind of, you know, should we just take off? Should we go back and just look at the... So we decided to go back to Bill's grave this morning, you know, and it was... and this will sound, this will sound less than masculine, but we went up there and we were the only ones there, you know. And has anybody ever been to Bill's grave, right, up on the hill, right? It's spectacular, you know, and the sun was up and there was a good breeze going. It's about 65 degrees, and my wife and I were the only two there, and we just stood there looking at the grave, and for 4 or 5 minutes, not talking, you know, and then we looked at each other and we were both crying, and, you know, and she said, if it wasn't, you know, obviously if it wasn't Bill Wilson, a lot of us would be dead. Probably most of us, you know, you don't realize that. And I didn't either, because I thought I wasn't that bad, but I just, AA kept slowing me down, you know. and saving me, stopping me for a little while, and then I'd get a little better, then I'd go again, and, you know, but if there's no AA, I'm not slowing down, and probably dead. But my wife, we're looking at each other, and she goes, you realize if without Bill Wilson, we would have never, you know, when I met my wife, I was sitting about where Julia is, and my wife was sitting right about where Scott was. And we faced this way in this meeting. The table was there, and that was the first time I ever saw my wife, you know, in this room. And we got married, and she said, and our son would never be born, you know. If it wasn't for Bill Wilson, my son would never be born, you know. And so anyway, that was a hell of a moment I'll never, ever, ever forget. You know, I'm grateful for AA, and I talked to a lot of interesting people over the weekend, and I'm not quite sure what I learned. If I figure it out, I'll let you know. But it was a great weekend. So anyway, we are still in Into Action. I do have a game plan to get this finished up. Doesn't seem like it, but we're going to skip a few chapters or brush over them. So we are on steps 8 and 9. You know, here's the one thing I will point out is somebody we were talking over the weekend. You know, you look at the third and the seventh step prayers, and really all this is to bring you to God, and to bring you to a relationship with your God, so that once you have that relationship, you can be of service to your fellows. You know, every day, all day. But we have to have that relationship with our higher power, as we understand him, or whatever you want to call it, but I'll call him God. You know, and just to, you know, my creator, I am now willing that you have all of me, good and bad. And that's a big statement. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to God and to my fellows. That's all we're, you know, get rid of our, you know, our defects, our shortcomings, so that we can better serve God and our fellows. You know, grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. And the third step prayer is, you know, in a different way says the same thing. So that's all this book is really trying to get us to do, is to find our God, and then to share him and give him to others so that they can have the strength to overcome, you know, first they're drinking and drugging, but then all the things that are causing them to have trouble with life, right? You know, we have a hole in our soul. We fill it with drugs and alcohol and other things, and we put the drugs and alcohol down. We fill it with all sorts of other things, you know. We need to fill it with God, you know, and that's where we find peace, you know, and I'll talk about that in a minute. And Anyway, it says, probably there are still some misgivings. As we look over the list of our business acquaintances and friends we have hurt, we may feel diffident about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. And so this is kind of like how my wife talks to me. They say the same thing over and over, and great instructions. I get a lot of instructions at home. Not all great, but I get a lot of them. But they just over and over and over and over, they kind of really try to reinforce the same. So there's a lot of great instructions in here that they really pound into us. Let us be reassured. To some people, we need not or probably should not emphasize the spiritual feature on our first approach. We might prejudice them. At the moment, we are trying to put our lives in order, and that's what the amends process. We are trying to right all the wrongs we have done, to get our scorecards back to zero, you know. But this is not an end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum use to service to God and the people about us. So if we are at odds with everybody in our life, we cannot be of maximum service to God or to anyone else. So that's, you know, the purpose of, you know, really steps 4 through 9. It's seldom wise to approach an individual who still smarts from our injustice to him and announce that we have gone religious. In the prize ring, it's called leading with the chin. We lay ourselves open to being branded as fanatics or religious bores. We may kill a future opportunity to carry a beneficial message, but our man is sure to be impressed with a sincere desire to right the wrong. He is going to be more interested in a demonstration of goodwill he's going to be more interested in a demonstration of our goodwill than in our talk of spiritual discovery. So that, I always try to have my coffee before we start this thing. That is what amends are. Amends are our demonstrations of our demonstrations. You know, it's not an apology. We'll get to that. It's not. It's a demonstration of our honest and sincere desire to right a wrong or an injustice or some form of bad behavior. It says we don't use this as an excuse for shying away from the subject of God. And this is a tricky subject, this God thing. You know me, I like to talk about it all the time. But you have to probably be a little more. You probably need to be better at it than I am. That's all I'll tell you. You know, you have to. You don't shy away from it, but you have to present it properly. When it will serve any good purpose, we are willing to announce our convictions with tact and common sense. The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. And this always comes up. You know, when we talked a little bit about amends, and, you know, I found the best way, and I hear it over and over and over, and I'm getting better. You know, one thing is, I was taught one way, and I was taught we do it exactly out of the book, because I was big about my version of AA for a long time. And my version got hurt myself and hurt a lot of other people. And then I swayed, luckily, to the other side of exactly out of the book. You know, I am becoming, and I'm careful, a little more flexible in the amends process. I've never used the word sorry, never used the word apologize, you know, never. I heard some woman a couple weeks ago say, to apologize with restitution. I think you were at that meeting, Max. She said that got me. That's what, you know, because it's hard not to say. I was told I could not use the word sorry or apologize, and, you know, made it awkward. But we wrote everything out, and, you know, when I do amends, we write them out, we edit them. It sounds, you know, like it sound may sound. Kind of fake, but it's you know, you get an index card, you know who, what it is, and then exactly what you're going to say, and you say it every day. I've got one guy who I guess it's not going that well. He hasn't been here in 2 weeks, but he's got a big amends he's supposed to be making to his ex-wife. And, you know, I asked him to please carry this card around in your pocket at all times, you know, because I feel if he can make this amends, it will free him up. He's stuck and he needs to get freed up, and I'm hoping that it will do it, but I haven't seen or heard from him in a while. But we write him out. You really almost rehearse him. You read him over and over and over and over. So when it comes time to make that amends, not only do you know exactly what you want to say. My first time I made amends, I had amends going on for half hour. You see when people share an AA, they can't land the plane. They just go on and on. You think this is a good place to end, and then they're going this way, and then they're going that way. And, you know, my friend George, you say, that guy can't land the plane, Kenny. But my amends were like that. I would just be going this way and that way. And really, because I knew once I stopped talking, they were going to probably say something I didn't want to hear. So I just kept talking, you know. But, you know, it's very big on, you know, almost rehearsing them in the mirror, being so prepared to present that amends exactly what you want to say. And you've read it so many times, it's real. It's not, you know, instead of, I would like to say I'm sorry to you for stealing your money. It was a bad thing to do, you know. But to really, you know, and so when we read them and we edit them and we change them and we, you know, I don't know how I got on this, but, the harder it is to go to an enemy. You know, and that's another thing I've heard lately is, you know, we do need, if we've had ill will towards somebody, I lost a guy. A guy I was sponsoring. I thought it was going great. He was on his amends. He had a cousin. What was his cousin's name? That was a funny name. But he owned a bunch of eye centers for your glasses, you know. And his cousin was a laser surgeon, and they were going to open up laser sites. Somehow the cousin got, and Uncle Milton, the uncle or something like that, was the accountant for the whole thing. And somehow the cousin, Fester, or some funny name, but he ripped them off for $1 million, and the whole deal fell apart. And I, you know, and this really ups, this, he was pissed at this guy. He acted like he wasn't, but you could tell. And on this thing, it was the biggest, most written out thing. So I kept suggesting and doing a card, and he, you know, and I said, I wish I could, I still have the text that he sent me. But I said, you just need to go to him and say, listen, Cousin Fester, or during that thing with the surgery centers, I had really deep hatred for you, and I can't live that way anymore, or something like that. And I just want you to know, it's important for me to get over it, and I am, and I want you to know that I regret having all that ill feeling. I forget what it was, but we had this card all set to go, and all of a sudden this guy disappeared. I said, "How you doing?" And I got this text that said, "I cannot go to a guy who ripped me off. I know AA is good and it's good something, but I cannot make an amends to someone who ripped me off. And I know if I don't do AA perfectly, I'll never be free. And I, between my wife and my brother and my doctor, I've decided to get the Vivitrol shot now." His whole thing was with dancers, you know, and so getting all the advice from his wife was a little counterintuitive, but you know, the whole thing was shocking. I'm getting Vivitrol, and I'm doing some method. I forget the method. I looked it up, and I forget what it was. But it's hard to go to the person we hate, and sometimes, you know, I'm feeling there's certain situations where you can resent the person and whatever, and sometimes there's not a need to make an amends to that person. I haven't come across that, but I'm becoming more open to that. But, you know, it says here, it's harder to go to an enemy than a friend. But we find it, you know, we find it much more beneficial to us. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, Cousin Fester, confessing our formal hatred or ill feeling and expressing our regret for that, you know. And I've heard of, I've seen, I didn't have any good ones myself, a little bit of this, but nothing. I've heard some really good ones, though. And the thing I was taught, and I heard it this weekend, is you know, with the index cards I do, we label them a 1, a 2, or a 3. You know, 1 being an easy 1, and we do those first, a 2 being a so-so 1, and a 3. Lately I've heard you can do it. It makes a little more sense to me is you just do a plus as somebody. If you saw them today, you go to them and you'd be willing to talk to them. And if you're not or you're hesitant, they're a minus. And the theory is that as you start doing your pluses and see the benefit, some of the minuses you can just make to pluses. You know, I like that. I like that way too. But you don't see the benefit if you don't make the amends. You know, if you sit down with somebody and you really express your regret, express your love for them, and your willingness to do anything to get them back in your life the way you want it, you will feel different. You will feel different. If you don't do it, you won't feel different, and your minuses will never become pluses. You know, so this is really, as I say, where the rubber meets the road. This changes your life. This really changes your life. Your amends. So it says here, under no condition do we criticize more. This is what my wife would tell me. Under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Simply, we tell him that we will never get over our drinking until we have done our utmost to straighten out the past. And I don't know if we phrase it that way. We just say, you know, I'm working hard on my recovery. You can say you're drinking if, you know, I said it with my parents, but, you know, we phrase it properly. We are there to sweep off our side of the street, realizing that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do so. And that's true. I mean, we lose a lot of people here. We lose a lot of people here. And this is where people will change or not change, depending on their willingness to be thorough. I was not... One of my early amends, and we're getting to the financial ones, I didn't really have any. I had to give my dad back a couple $1,000 because I told him I crashed somebody's car, but it was a bad cocaine deal that I had lost money. And so I asked him for a couple $1,000. I said I crashed someone's car, and he said, wired the money, and I paid off a cocaine debt, and I had to admit that and pay him the money back in my amends. But when I was early in sobriety and doing my first round of this stuff, and I felt like I had to have a financial amends because I really didn't have any at that time, I told a boss of mine. I used to run a facilities management thing. It's this big law firm in the city. I ran the messengers and the taxis and the all sorts of things for the lawyers. And I had a petty cash box, and I would every night take a token out of it to take the subway home. You know, so over the time, I maybe took $30. You know, tokens were a dollar back then. So to make up a financial amends, so I could say I did a financial amends, I went to my boss, who were really good friends. So I thought this was going to be, you know, and I said, "Hey, Walter, I got to, you know, I'm trying to straighten out my past, and I again no index card, so I'm going." Flying a plane around the Citicorp Center for a while, and I said, something I need to straighten out. I've been taking tokens to get home out of petty cash, and it's probably $20, but I'd like to give you $30 at least to just make it, you know, right, and blah blah. And he said, "All right, let us do an audit on your box. We'll get back to you." You know, so I'm like, "All right, I'm telling you, it's $20, but whatever you want to do, you know." So he comes back about a week later. He goes, "Your box is $900 short, you know." And there's no way, you know. But what could I say, right? You know. So they'd start garnishing my wages, you know. So that was my. I'm sure there's a story there. I haven't learned it yet, but anyway, I paid the $900 back, and I was like, "Did somebody else get in the box, or you know?" Because I know. But anyway, his faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. And if our manner is calm, frank, and opened, and we've rehearsed our index card, we will be gratified with the result. In 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens. Sometimes the man we are calling upon admits his own fault. And feuds of years standing melt away in an hour. Rarely do we fail to make satisfactory progress, and that's true. Our former enemies sometimes praise what we are doing and wish us well. Occasionally they will offer assistance. It should not matter. However, if someone does throw us out of the office, we've made our demonstration on our part. It's water over the dam. I've had people I've made amends to years later. One person, let's not say people, one person, come back to me with their child, you know, and say, you know, you talked about this, and it was from the amends I had made, and it was actually turned out to be a great story. The kid is sober today. Most alcoholics owe money, more than they think. We do not dodge our creditors. Telling them what we're trying to do, we make no bones about our drinking. Usually they know anyway whether we think so or not. Nor are we afraid of disclosing our alcoholism on theory it may cause financial harm. Approached in this way, the most ruthless creditor will sometimes surprise us. Arranging the best deal we can, we let these people know we're sorry. Our drinking has made us slow to pay. We must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go, for we are liable, so we, as the first 100 people, are liable to drink if we're afraid of them. So when you work with people, this is an interesting thing, and like anything, you can only put it out there and try to explain the benefit to them. When it comes to financial amends, people are either on it, not enough. They're either on it, though. I have one guy who's got a big one, and he's waiting till the 7 years are up, but he intends to do it. He's at 6 years right now, and it's a lot of money. Or they really brush over it. They brush over, like, there's no way I can do it, so why do we even bother talking about it, you know? And that's where you have to really start saying, let's talk about $10 a week, or let's talk about something, because it's the same, any action we take. I talked last week about, if I get down on my knees in the morning and talk to God, I've talked to God that day, so I need to behave that day in a way somebody who talked to God has to behave, you know? If I don't talk to God, I'm not on the leash, you know. I can kind of wander around, and it's the same with amends. So I find it important to get people paying something back, because that action puts muscle in your sobriety. I believe wholeheartedly. So, but it's a funny experience when you work with people, and you can see how desperate they are. And my desperation was warped, obviously. I felt I had to find a financial amends, so I went to this guy, and it really backfired. But, you know, I didn't, and I had with my dad, you know, and I had to go to him and say, you know, remember that time I told you? Well, that wasn't the case. It was a bad drug deal. I didn't say cocaine. I owed somebody money for drugs, and I had to get money quickly, and I thank you, and I paid him back, and that hurt him, you know, although it wasn't the first time I had hurt him. So anyway, it says, perhaps we have committed a criminal offense, which might land us in jail if it were known to authorities. We may be short in our accounts and unable to make good. We have already admitted that we've already admitted this in confidence to another person. But we are sure we would be imprisoned or lose our job if it were known. Maybe it's only a petty offense, such as stealing tokens out of the petty cash box. Most of us have done that sort of thing. Maybe we are divorced, and I had two guys on Friday going, I read the big book with. So maybe we're divorced and have remarried, but have not kept up alimony to number one. She's indignant about it, and there's a warrant out for our arrest. And that's not the case these days. Well, I guess it can be. Not. I have not seen that lately, but it's a tough deal, you know. It's a tough deal with child custody, and you can see the pain, you know. She's indignant. There's a warrant out for arrest. This is common trouble, too. Although these reparations take innumerable forms, there are some good, some general principles which we find guiding. Reminding ourselves that we have decided to go to any length to find a spiritual experience, we ask that we be given the strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences. And that's a big statement there. We may lose our position or reputation or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink at anything. And it's funny, just maybe when I read that, you know, I just mentioned a guy who's got a big financial amends to make, and he's going to make it, but he is waiting for the 7 years to be up, you know. So I'm like, wait a minute, that's not, I'm proud of him, but maybe I need to go back and say, let's read this part of the book. But usually, however, there's other people involved. Therefore, we are not hasty or foolish martyr who would needlessly sacrifice others to save himself from the alcoholic pit. A man we know remarried because of a resentment and drinking. He had not paid alimony to his first wife. She was furious. She went to court, ordered for his arrest, blah, blah, blah. And so this is good. It says, we thought he ought to be willing to do what's necessary, but if he were in jail, he could not provide for either family. So, you know, we have to, this is where a sponsor comes in. You know, I shared the thing when my buddy made his amends to his wife, his ex-wife, and he went off the card and shared about, he couldn't land the plane, and he shared about driving the kids around drunk for years, you know, which she was totally unaware of, and she went bananas, and he sat there going, I don't understand. But that would injure others. Before taking drastic action, which might implicate others, we secure their consent. We have obtained permission, we have consulted with others, ask God to help, and the drastic step is indicated. If indicated, we must not shrink. This brings us to a story. I'm going to skip the story. At the bottom it says, the chances are that we have domestic troubles. We may be mixed up with women in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised. And we've talked about this to death. So we will try to... we doubt if, in this respect, alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people. Drinking does complicate sex relations in the home. After a few years with an alcoholic, a wife gets worn out, resentful, and uncommunicative. And that was the thing with Lois, man. I mean, when they, that documentary, and that's the thing too. If Lois had left Bill, which she should have, 1,000 times, you know, he probably, again, wouldn't have carried on with AA. So God bless Lois. You know, she hung in there, man, and she went to work every day, and there's really not much talk of her. Yeah, you know, there was a scene in the movie where Bill's passed out on the bed, or the guy's playing Bill, and she's cleaning the house, making the dinner, doing everything, and he's just on the bed, you know, and she's working at the store, and you don't hear about her bitching, I'll tell you. I mean, my wife would have tossed me, but you know, if not, she'd be bitching the whole way. And not to single out my wife. I think a lot of wives, but maybe I'm wrong. After a few years, it gets worn out. How could she be anything else? Her husband, and this is great, husband begins to feel lonely and sorry for himself. He commences to look around the nightclubs or the equivalent for something besides liquor. Perhaps he is having a secret and exciting affair with the girl who understands. In fairness, we must say that she may understand, but what are we going to do about a thing like that? A man so involved often feels very remorseful at times. That's usually usually afterwards, especially if he is married to a loyal and courageous girl who has literally gone through hell for him. And that's something you can talk to your sponsor about. I'm going to leave my two cents out of that one. Whatever the situation, we are usually have to do something about it. And this is great advice, and this is something I have had experience with, and it has never gone well. If we are sure our wife does not know, should we tell her? No, not always. And not always we think. That's the first 100 people. If she knows in a general way we have been wild, should we tell her in detail? Undoubtedly, we should admit her fault. She may insist on knowing all the particulars. She will want to know who the woman is and where she is. We feel we ought to say to her, we have no right to involve the other person. We are sorry for what we have done. God willing, it shall not be repeated. And it can get repeated, you know, nowadays with this Tinder and all this crap that, I mean, it's the Wild West out there today, man, I'll tell you. You watch guys go through these phases. They get divorced and they go to Tinder and they come out of Tinder and then they've got all these amends. Well, they don't call them amends, but they got to get them off the Facebook thing or whatever they're doing, you know. And it takes a lot of work, you know. I was thinking, I was talking to somebody, you know, my thing is you know, no relationships for a year. You can't grow spiritually when you're new. You cannot grow. We're here to grow spiritually towards God and change and grow spiritually and change. You can't do that when you're in a relationship, because you can't do both very well. I think you have to do one or the other. You can't do both. If you're getting involved with this stuff, yeah, I got a great guy. He's got 12 years, or he's got some time. But he did this. I'm not going to go into the whole story. It's crazy. But he got into the, He had an affair. He got divorced. He was with the affair girl. Then that was going south. So then he went to Tinder. Then he was showing Michael the Tinder. And then that's Michael's problem. And now Michael's dead. But now he's off the Tinder, you know. It's just bad. It's just bad. It's not what God wants. That's all I can tell you. We have no right to go further. Though there may be justifiable exceptions, and though we wish to lay down no rule of any sort, we have often found this is the best course to take. Our design for living is not a one-way street. It is as good for the wife as for the husband. If we can forget, so can she. It is better, however, that one does not needlessly name a person upon whom she can vent. Yet that I've never seen. Forgiveness is really hard in this area. So, again, that's something you need to talk about with your sponsor. Better advice I can give you, don't do it. You know, then you don't have to talk to your sponsor, which is always good. Perhaps there are some cases where the utmost frankness is demanded. No outsider can appraise such an intimate situation. It may be that both will decide that the way of good sense and loving kindness is to let bygones be bygones. Things must have been a lot different back then. I've never seen bygones. Each might pray about it, having the other one's happiness uppermost in mind. I'm throwing the flag there. There's one person who's not praying for the other one's happiness. Keep it always in sight that we are dealing with the most terrible human emotion. They call it jealousy. There's a lot of things we can call it. Good generalship may decide that the problem be attacked on the flank rather than face-to-face combat. This is a tough deal. this is a tough and sad, sad deal that alcohol causes. It causes, right? It makes us do things. It makes us do things to fill the hole in our soul so we can feel better. It's selfishness and self-centeredness at its best. But we rationalize it in our minds. And but when the smoke clears and it's time to get better, it's a big uphill. It's a big uphill battle. But great things can happen, you know. You can come out the better for it, but you know, not always. So don't do it. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say, sometimes we hear an alcoholic say that the only thing he needs to do is keep sober. That is a bad statement. Certainly he must keep sober, for there would be no home if he doesn't. But he is yet a long way from making good to the wife or parents for whom for years he is so shockingly treated. Passing all understanding is the patience mothers and wives have had with alcoholics. Had this not been so, many of us would have no homes today, or perhaps be dead. I used to never like this statement. I thought it was kind of dated, but I do like it. It says, "The alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others." But these are deep, powerful statements here. Hearts are broken, right? What's the worst? I mean, how much worse can you do than breaking your mother's heart, right? Or your mother or your father's heart or your wife's heart. Hearts are broken. Sweet relationships are dead, right? We all had good people in our lives at some point, and we were given the ultimatum, choose me or alcohol. And of course we said, I choose you, but that's not what our actions showed. And those good people we had in our lives are gone. Affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a man is unthinking when he says sobriety is enough. And you do hear that. You hear it and you see it more so. You see it in people's behavior. They think they're doing the deal. They think by going to meetings that's enough. But they're not taking the actions to right the wrongs and to change their lives, you know. I know I did for years and years and years. And I know when I took the actions and I changed my life, how wonderful it is. But it's hard to get that message across. Taking action is never fun, but it's always, always rewarding, except for that $900. Don't see anything... yes, there is a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fill the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we see it now. And here's more instructions, being very careful not to criticize. I'm going to get my wife to read this. We had a blow up before going to the Wilson house. The smoke detector went off. The battery went dead, started chirping at 4 in the morning, and she had asked me to change the batteries a week ago. And oh, Christ. It was brutal. The broken shoelace, right? Their defects may be glaring, but chances are that our own actions are mostly responsible. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience and tolerance. So that's something we need to have internally. Mm-hmm. But kindliness and love is something we need to express to people. And that's they're all hard. But kindliness, patience and tolerance is something I need to have with people. I'm getting a little better at, long way to go. But I need to express kindness and love, and that I have a long way to go. But that's very, very important. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. I wish I had more time. That is, you can see someone who's spiritual. You can see through their actions, through their participation in meetings, and I mean doing coffee and chairs, and you can see someone who where the light bulb has gone off. You know, we have to live it, and we don't have to, but if you do, you'll find peace. You know, you'll find freedom, and you'll find peace. So you don't have to. You should, if you want good things to happen. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought to not urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone. And when they say our behavior, that, you know, let's not brush over that line. Our behavior is the only thing that can convince them. You know, I mean, my wife and I, we were 5-7 years sober when we got married, you know, but I still, I did a lot of wrong things. And I, every day, almost every day, you know, do dishes and vacuum and try to make her life better. Except for those batteries, but because if you miss one, boy, look out. But that's, you know, that's somebody taught me, this guy Tom Curran. Yeah, I said, "What do you do?" He goes, "I do a lot of dishes. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of dishes." You know, and that's that. They, you know, like I had done the dishes before we went to Vermont, and she got there thinking she had to do them, and they were done. You know. Three cheers for me. There may be some wrongs we can never fully right. Don't worry about them. If we honestly say to ourselves we would right them if we could. Some people can't be seen. We send them an honest letter. Or a lot of people, you know what, we can donate money to their church. There's always a way. A good sponsor can always help you find an action to take that will bring about peace. You know, some guys, their grandmother, they stole something, and so we give money to their church in their name. You know, we take an action. One guy took money and put it at his grandmother's grave, I guess, for someone, the lawnmower guy, to steal. But whatever, you know, he did it, you know. It wasn't my first choice, but some cannot be valid reason to postpone in some cases. But we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, this is where a sponsor helps. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone. And before I get to the promises, I love doing index cards with people, you know, assisting. You know, I do it a lot, and it's a wonderful thing to do, because you're trying to right a wrong. You know, you're trying to express something. It's a wonderful act to take. You know, is to sit with someone and do their index. We always use a pencil because we do a lot of erasing. You know, but anyway, so here's something that always bothers me. This is the one of the, you know, and I think I probably said it the first week. You know, they read the promises at the end of, you know, AA has gotten so watered down. The latest one I've seen is this group has a people willing to be temporary sponsors, you know. Now, that was never said 5 years ago, right? They get this crap, they get all this crap out of the rehabs and the detoxes, mm-hmm. You know, 90 and 90. That's a great suggestion. But they get a lot of stuff, it comes out of the detoxes and rehabs, and it dilutes AA. And the thing that gets me is at the end here, I'm going to go, you know, are these extravagant promises? you bet your ass they're these are really fucking really extravagant promises. You know, yeah, they are. It says, we think not. Those were the first 100 people who had done, made all their amends. But you got the guy here for his third meeting and get him chanting, we think not, with a room full of people who have no idea where that came from. You know, are we serving that? I came in and thought if I did a 90-90, I would get these promises through us. I honestly believed that. I thought that's how it worked, you know. And that's obviously, I'm not a good gauge of intelligence, but that was what I got. So I really think, you know, there's so many things, and the latest one is temporary. Now, that comes out of the Del Rey shuffle when you're down there for 6 months, and right? You get a temporary sponsor in Florida while you're there, but when you come back to New Jersey, you get a real sponsor. Mm-hmm. But you've got groups up here that think, oh, and I called a group who I like, the Pilgrim group, you know. I went to a group conscious. I said, what's up? You know, I thought, I love the message they deliver. Mm-hmm. And when I pointed that out, one guy goes, well, we feel that it puts less pressure on them, you know.
Right.
And I said, I cease fighting everything and everyone. We feel it gives them a little more wiggle or less pressure on them or something like that.
Right.
So they still do it. And I don't raise my hand and now I have to try to be a bigger person, which is really hard. And, you know, who's willing? And I don't put my hand up. I'm not willing. I'm not, you know. And I have to try to outgrow my immaturity and put my hand up. But so it says here, if we are, and here's the word, painstaking, you know, it doesn't say if we are good about this phase. It says painstaking about this phase of our development. We'll be amazed before we're halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. I always wondered that because I didn't know an old freedom or an old happiness when I was drinking. But we're going to know freedom and happiness. We will not regret our past or wish to shut the door on it. And that's a great promise, you know. And we'll get to why in a minute. It says, we will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. And that is such a wonderful, if that happens to you, you are that. I think that is, you know, a big part of the essence of a spiritual awakening. But it says here, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, and in my opinion, the further the better, we will see how our experience can benefit others. You know, and it says we will not regret because our experience, you know, when you go into these places and you get someone in a detox who's been there 10 times. And if you can get that person sober and through the work and then working with other people, they are gold. You know, they are gold. The further down the scale you have gone, I think the less, it said at the Wilson House, using curse words was a lack of spiritual growth,
right,
or something. But I can't think of real words. Oh, curse words are coming to mind. you know, they will be tougher on. So they will call someone out on their inability to be truthful. If that doesn't seem very strong, you know what I'm saying, though. How far down the scale we go? Our experience can and will benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. This is a tough one. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our others. And if you can see that in people, you know, that's a great sign of spiritual awakening. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook on life will change. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. So somebody said over the weekend that the fear of it, economic insecurity won't leave, but the fear of it will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. And this, when you can see this, and we were kind of talking about this before the meeting, it said we suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. When it occurs to you that God got you sober, that and you stop thinking you're getting yourself sober by coming to these kind of meetings and doing your 90 and 90, and you know, God, you put yourself in the position to let God do you know, God's work. But when I realized, and again, it took me a long time, that was a huge turning point for me. And it says, are these extravagant promises? We, the first 100 people, think not, because we have gone through the steps and we have made direct amends. We have done all this work. So we think not. You people who are new, you should think they are. But they are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. And I fell short here, but I am going to stop there for tonight at step 10. Thank you.
All right.